Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Winnie DeStevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, Illegal Immigrant No More, the Associated Press style book has banned that term, and new standards that will have a huge impact on your child's learning. Plus, the Fresno Film Festival bringing movies to the Valley you want to see. But first on our program, living in the San Joaquin Valley of California, the ban of the use of the term illegal immigrant by the Associated Press has huge implications for the region, especially for journalists who cover the region. In this segment of Valley Edition, we discuss the implications of the decision for the region and whether that decision is positive or not. Joining us on the phone is Edward Schumacher Matos. Mr. Matos is the ombudsman for NPR. And Juan Esperanza, the editor of Vida en el Valle, Spanish language newspaper, and joining us later will be Sabina Gonzalez, Regional Director for Communities for A New California Contact. Okay, thank you both, Mr. Schumacher Matos.
Yes.
And Juan, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Hi, Juan.
Hello.
First of all, Juan, as someone who is the editor of a newspaper, what were your thoughts when you found out that the Associated Press was, banning that particular term as far as for reporters to use in their description of someone who may be in the country illegally?
Yes. Well, I welcome the AP's decision, and I congratulate them. We have banned that use. In our publication, which began in August of 1990, we have always used undocumented. We don't follow strictly the AP style book because we are a bilingual publication, and there's some usage that sort of like either in Spanish or in English, we have to be careful as to how it is used. But I think the AP made the right decision into coming into the 21st century, much like years and years ago. Maybe there were other terms that were used, and through time, it's the style is something that evolves, just like laws. They evolve with time and with the social changes in this country. So it was a great decision by the AP, but I think it was very, very long overdue.
Mr. Schumacher Matos, being the ombudsman for NPR, what kind of implications do you think this might have on a national level here in this region because of our population? I think, much of the media is really sensitive about the terms they use to describe whatever ethnic group. But what is your feeling on what kind of impact this might have nationwide? And what do you think precipitated it?
Well, I agree with what Juan said when he said, that terms, if I can paraphrase him, take on different meanings over time. And so the big issue on this terminology debate is, where do we stand as a nation on the meaning of these phrases over time, or today at least. And so I think, the AP's decision to change their terminology is part of a ongoing transition in terminology on, here nationally on what's accepted or not accepted or how terms are interpreted. The term undocumented alien, I'm sorry, undocumented actually comes out of California and to a large extent even the Central Valley. It comes out of the early Chicano movement and it was a heavily loaded term by some of the early, for lack of a better word, separatists and things like that. The ones, that whole Aztlan movement that existed once upon a time and that type of a thing. But it sort of spread from there, and it's just become much more accepted across the country. And so, it's no longer associated with those early roots, but you can understand why some people reject it, in part because of those early roots, in part because a lot of folks actually have documents, they're just the wrong documents. But words take on meanings of their own over time, and this has become, more and more the accepted word nationally.
You know, that is so true. Something that may, and we've seen it with a number of instances, you will have terms or words that have one meaning, but over time they start taking on a whole different, used in a whole different kind of context.
Right. As we all know, illegal alien is actually the correct legal phrase, and it's the one that's in so many laws and regulations and so forth. And I myself was once an illegal alien, and it wasn't a phrase that bothered me. But today, that's a toxic phrase among so many Americans, and because of that, it shouldn't be used. Though there are a certain number of Americans, who want to try and stick to that older terminology. And let me say this for, and Juan, I used to edit a chain of Spanish language papers in Texas, so I totally understand where you're coming from on that. And we did the exact same thing you're doing. But there are some, there are Americans who are, that it really is important to them, this whole concept of laws. It's not just a matter of racism and that kind of a thing, but the idea of people breaking the law is something that's just very, very important to them. And so, when they begin seeing something that they think of, you're trying to redefine the issue on them, they get their backs up by it. And we have to have a certain sympathy for Americans who are concerned about the legal status of things. I don't have any sympathy for the people who are racist about this thing.
But that is part of the, as you just stated, with it being a legal term, do you expect or think that there will be some media who will continue to use the term?
Which one? Illegal immigrant or illegal alien?
No, illegal. No, illegal alien, because there are people who
unauthorized immigrant, and I think that that's the one that most policy wonks now use, and that goes back to the whether or not you're breaking, what kind of laws you're breaking or not breaking, and that type of a thing. Are they, administrative things? Are they criminal laws? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and as well as the whole idea of you don't want to, this whole thing of coloring a whole class of people is just, in a negative way, is something to be very concerned about. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Juan.
Yes, to answer your question, I think there are some media that don't prescribe to the AP style book for one reason or another. And some media like us, we massage the style book and determine our own usage. I understand the Los Angeles Times is going to be making a decision as to what term to use sometime this month. So I think for the foreseeable future, there will be some news media that will still use the term illegal immigrant or illegal alien. But I think with time, it will die away. And I think one of the biggest problems with the terms that are used is that there is so much misinformation that is out there on the immigration debate, on undocumented or illegal immigrants. Anytime you watch something on TV, and TV is so visual, the only thing they resort to is people jumping the border. When 40% of the undocumented residents in the country overstay their visas. So it's just that misinformation you know, people see TV and they get this visual element of, okay, those are lawbreakers right there. They came across without any papers, when they don't realize that a vast majority came over with visas.
Well, you know, that as what you just mentioned, I think is key, because the media and the images that they put out can be very powerful. And that's why it's important. And a lot of times, maybe not a lot of thought goes into the term you are using when you're showing certain video. And I think we've seen this in the media over and over and over again, you know, by identifying people in a certain way can have huge consequences for that particular ethnic group or that particular organization or anything.
You're absolutely right. And let me say that I actually used to teach. I was a lecturer precisely on immigration policy issues at Harvard for 3 years before taking this ombudsman slot on. And you know, and everything that Juan says is true. So the 40% figure might be off in that it's been an accepted figure for a long time, but there's a whole new body of research starting to come up that says it's maybe it's less than that, but it doesn't make any difference. Whatever it is, you know, that negative image of you know, undocumented immigrants is in the media, oftentimes, you know, it gives you this idea that we're being flooded by all these folks, and you know, coming across the border, and it looks somehow they look undesirable, right, and presented in a certain light, oftentimes. And when we know that that's really not true,
but doesn't sometimes the public, mm-hmm. or either a public outcry or opposition from a particular group that can have an impact. I can remember as a reporter in newsrooms when it was decided that, let's say, if a description was put out for a criminal that the police were looking for.
Right.
And we would identify the person as a black man in his 50s.
Right.
Well, they quit doing that because there are a lot of black men in their 50s. And it was, you right. had to be, for you to use the identity, you had to be more descriptive. You had to have more information. And in a way, that's what this is saying. If you're going to use the term, you've got to, in a way, explain exactly why you're using it and under the terms that you're using it.
Well, I totally agree with you, and you're absolutely right on that. And what's happened, you know, the correction that was made for race, particularly concerning blacks, on regular news stories has not been made for immigrants on regular news stories, both documented and undocumented. So often, you know, we go ahead and say it has nothing at all to do with the story, but suddenly a person's identified as an immigrant, or particularly an undocumented immigrant, right? Especially if it's something like a traffic accident or something bad, and it has nothing at all to do with whatever happened. That's one that I think that has to be corrected across the news media. It's just done by people without thinking, the same way it happened with blacks without thinking over so much time in our history.
And as I mentioned before, it does when it comes to describing or having people's mindset or the way they
right.
might think about a certain group. If you put images with certain words, they can be very powerful.
Yeah.
You
no,
know,
you're absolutely right. But let me flip you the reverse question, and Juan might have some ideas on this about undocumented and that phrase. The people who oppose undocumented make the argument that it is an attempt to wash away the illegality of coming into the country illegally, If by doing that, it makes it seem like there's nothing wrong with coming into the country illegally. It's the exact same argument, but seen the other way around, right? And so this is their great concern. How do we respond to that?
Well, that's a great question. And the thing is that undocumented is a more fairer, a more humane term that can be used. Now, it could be that within 3 to 5 years, maybe we're going to be looking for a different term to use. But if you call someone undocumented, you're not labeling them as inhumane. In some quarters, it's taken as derogatory, just like you call someone a wetback.
That's derogatory in all quarters.
Correct. So I mean, it's a softer word. You're in no way making the person a legal resident, a documented resident, by calling someone undocumented. And yes, there are stories that we work on, and we find out that the person is undocumented. So we have to determine, okay, how important is that person's status to the story? And that's something we have to weigh and make a decision on. I think along the border, I grew up in the El Paso area, and my stepfather was a sheriff's deputy, and he was white. And I noticed that in his banter with other Mexicans, with family members, the term wetback would come out, and it was like it was not a derogatory term the way the word was used. And I think along the border, it's like there's this much more give and take than once immigration debate goes nationally, mm-hmm. and it goes into places where undocumented immigrants have not really had a long history there. That's when you start using, the terms illegal alien, illegal immigrant, illegal resident, mm-hmm. that it starts to become a harsher term. So mm-hmm. what I'm saying is that the term undocumented is less harmful to the individual than illegal.
Well, I'd like to bring in Sabina Gonzalez. She's the Regional Director for Communities for A New California. And, she works with so many students and people in the community. Sabina, you've heard part of the discussion. And, what is your concern, or what do you think people's concern are when it comes to how they are being identified, people who are in this country?
Thank you, Juanita. And, as you mentioned, Communities for New California, a lot of our work does have to do with highlighting the voice of immigrants, immigrant students, immigrant children, immigrant mothers, and as well as other working people. And two things that I want to point out is that no matter how people, no matter how some of us are using the term wetback or illegal or any of these other words, these are words that come from hate, and I think that once, what we've noticed in our work is that once you give this community a face and you start to get to know the families and the children, you say the word wetback to a child, even though you might not think it's a hateful thing to say, that's a word that's born from hate, and none of us are going to take that away. And if we're teaching our children that, it does have an impact on them. And another thing that I wanted to point out as well is that in our work, what we're noticing, I'll give Fresno County as an example, a lot of our work has to do with reaching out to voters. And we've noticed, made some strides in making sure that newly registered voters, a lot of whom are immigrants in Fresno County, that we are in communication with them about, what do you think are priorities? What do you think about these terms, wetback? What do you think about illegal? How do you see the future of our county and our state? And it really, I think it's understated how much of a big deal it is for our community. We live in a valley where one of every three people are immigrants, and they're becoming our voters. They're becoming our workforce. So I think in our government, that's not reflected yet. And we think these terms, illegal, wetback, aren't a big deal. But when you go down door to door, when you spend, 80% of your time going door to door, you'll know this is a big deal.
Has there been any talk at all, and you say you deal with these folks in terms of being a voters, of how they want to be identified?
I think it varies. I think, Juan, to Juan's point about it can maybe not be a big deal to some folks. I think it varies. Some people want to be called Latinos. Some people want to be called Mexican. Some people want to be called, immigrants. I think it varies from person to person. But the one thing that I see as a constant is that when I use a term to describe you that clearly came from hate, that's not going to be so popular.
And I would think, too, with our other two guests, that using a word, it really is how you use the word, and it's how the media uses the word. at that particular time that really makes the difference.
That is true. I mean, in the Latino music world, for example, there's a Spanish language group that plays popular norteño type music, Grupo Mojado, popular in the 80s. More recently, Los Ilegales, which is a more contemporary type group, they use that term. I mean, they don't use it to yell out to other people, like Sabina said, you know, with the term of hatred. So I think it's going to be an ongoing discussion, you know, how people use those terms and whether they use them to hurt other people, just by the use of the term.
But in the end, what the AP has done, and we've seen it before with so many other terms and so many other ethnic groups, it really does, in a way, starts reflecting the time, and it's reflecting either pressure from a group or just a change in our society as a whole when it comes to the way we might describe, certain groups or certain ethnic groups. And so it'll be interesting to see, like you said, the LA Times is studying it now and some other papers, and they may decide to come up with something entirely different. It doesn't mean that everybody's going to follow what the AP says. Because as you mentioned, Juan, you folks already use a different term.
Yes, we've used undocumented since we began publication. And the only thing that's wrong with that, and this is from a media perspective, when you write headlines and you have a one-column headline to write, it's very difficult to get the word undocumented in there. So, I mean, that's about the only bad thing of using undocumented, but we sort of see our way around that.
I'd like to go back to the conversation before about the term illegal and undocumented, but especially illegal. I think Juan makes a good point. That's not always used with hate, but I think it does. It has connotations in the conversation. You know, when I remember first beginning my work with community, I remember one older man that had been in it for a long time telling me, you know, you show me one invitation that any one of our forefathers or any one of our ancestors had. Who came with their invitation to come to the country? You know, nobody did. I don't remember seeing any invitations. The only ones probably Native Americans. You know, you can't argue with that. But other than that, I think that words like illegal continue to make it seem and make it normal that that it's possible for someone to be illegal. You know, and continue to forget and separate us from everyone else that came before that also didn't have an invitation.
I mean,
that has to be said, and it's very easy to forget. That is a very easy thing to forget. Go ahead, Mr. Schumacher.
Yeah, if I could respond to that. I mean, if you carry that argument to its logical conclusion, it's an open borders argument. And that's just a non-sale for anybody, or almost anybody in the United States, including in the Latino community. If you look at, you know, every poll of Latinos,
I'm not a saleswoman, so that's okay with
me. You should not have the, you know, open borders, and you should indeed have more border enforcement, as a matter of fact. I'm talking about what Latinos say in polls. I'm not trying to say we should. I'm just trying to tell you. And if you believe in social welfare for Americans and the things that you're working on with your communities program and so forth, how do you maintain those and finance those if you take an attitude that says it's all right to be undocumented, or it's all right to come into the country illegally. Do you know what I'm trying to say? So, I guess that's my question back to you on that.
Sabina?
I think that's probably putting words in my mouth. You know, I think it's one conversation is to talk about what we call people. You know, how I regard you, Juanita, or you, Juan, as individuals. You know, I'm not going to call you out of your name. I'm going to talk about you as people. I'm going to talk about you as human beings that, for whatever reason, find themselves in a situation where they need to move. So I think that one way to, we need to separate this from the emotion to some extent. We want to talk about truth and be flat out, you know, be flat out about it. Let's call people by their name. Let's call people human beings. And if we want to then limit immigration, that's fine. But let's do it on the basis, you know, let's not do it below the belt. If we want to limit immigration, let's talk about economics. Let's talk about lack of jobs. Let's talk about how we do it. But let's not get into the emotion and the hate of calling someone illegal, right? You found yourself in an impoverished situation and you tried to run to make it better for your family. That's a fact, right? But for me to then call you illegal and then call you a wetback and then put a judgment on you,
well, you
that's,
know what?
Just, that's two separate conversations.
Because our conversation is about illegal immigrant, and we're not talking about a derogatory term such as wetback. So I want to make sure that that's not, you know, that's not part of the conversation, you know, that we're trying to have. We're trying to look at this particular term and this particular way of identifying people, and you've had a major media organization say, okay, we're not going to use that term anymore. Mm-hmm. But you're right. You know, feelings are very strong when it comes to any issue when it comes comes to immigration. So it'll be interesting to see if other papers follow suit and what kind of changes this could make, because it really does, you know, how people are described does make a difference.
Add one more thing that we can apply this to every other conversation we're having at the national level. You know, you don't have to call someone outside of their name, a welfare queen, a lazy person. You don't have to do that. We can talk about, you know what, Juanita, you can't come to this country illegally. You can't do that. And we're going to limit that. And if you try to do that, here are the consequences. But that's very different. That's very different than naming a whole community of people illegal or unworthy. Right? Very different.
Raquel, I'm sorry.
Sabina.
Is it Raquel?
It's Sabina, and Sabina, we're just about out of time. So.
But, you know, let me just say one last thing. Sabina's argument is the argument that's behind the AP's change, and it's the argument of moving away from adjectives on so many things and describing actions instead. And I think she's perfectly right with what she just said.
And thank you all. I appreciate all of your comments. Juan Esperanza, editor of Vida en el Valle newspaper, Sabina Gonzalez, regional director for communities for New California, and also Mr. Edward Schumacher Matos, the ombudsman for NPR. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, earlier this month, the New York Times touted Los Angeles for being the first major city in the world to synchronize every one of its 4,500 traffic signals. But closer to home, a similar project is already underway in Fresno, which could make commutes on Shaw Avenue quicker by the end of April. Valley Public Radio's Ezra Romero reports.
We've all been there. Stuck in traffic at red light after red light. And when the line of cars finally begins to move, yes, you've guessed it, another traffic signal. But for drivers on Fresno's notoriously busy Shaw Avenue, a new high-tech traffic synchronization project might soon make the commute a little more bearable. It's part of a citywide project that Patrick Y. Miller, Fresno's public works director, calls an intelligent transportation system.
Rather than operating traffic controls through mechanized operations, we do it through computerization and live real-time communication between monitoring points so that we can have basically software that along a given corridor traffic that's communicating to other locations and able to track what's going on with traffic.
Over the last year, crews have been working to install the synchronization equipment along an 8.5-mile stretch of Shaw Avenue from Highway 99 to Highway 168. The city expects the project to be complete by the end of April. But Shaw Avenue isn't the first major street in Fresno to get the synchronization treatment. Over the last 6 years, Herndon, Blackstone, and Clovis Avenues have all been upgraded.
altogether close to 100 intersection light signals that are controlled or influenced by intelligent transportation and traffic synchronization, and we hope to get that number close to 500 by the time we're done. We've just got a little over 500 signalized intersections here in the city of Fresno.
But what exactly is traffic synchronization?
Synchronization is really an old idea, and that is that you have a progression of signals and that they are coordinated so that as traffic moves from signal to signal, that it turns green at the time that the traffic arrives.
That was Randolph Hall, a professor of industrial and systems engineering at the University of Southern California and the editor of the Handbook of Transportation Science. He says the latest generation of synchronization takes advantage of new technology to optimize traffic flow and keep cars moving. In the case of Fresno system, sensors are implanted in city streets. The sensors gather real-time information and send it through an underground fiber optic cable network to the city's central traffic operation system, where traffic flow then can be regulated.
And in doing that, we can then coordinate the traffic signals in a way that moves cars in platoons, if you will, in groups, and moves them along and is able to reduce or eliminate their stops at red lights and able to move them along at the posted speed limit and be able to avoid or at least minimize the amount of time they would otherwise be stopped at intersections and idling.
But the effort isn't just about making it quicker to get from one side of town to the other. It's also about improving air quality.
The main point of the system is to improve our air quality and reduce those emissions. We have the added benefits that it decreases commute times, and it increases the quality of life and the enjoyment of traveling by vehicle across our city.
The existing traffic light synchronization projects, including the Shaw Avenue project, have been funded through $25 million of air quality grants from the federal government. The Shaw Avenue project cost $3.5 million. But even with all the new technology behind the new computerized traffic system, both Weimiller and Hall agree that the success of Fresno's system rests largely with motorists themselves.
When you synchronize, it's always based on an assumed speed of traffic, and that can be the speed limit. It could be a little bit above the speed limit.
Hall says that those who like to speed won't likely see any benefits.
So if you're driving either slower or faster than the assumed progression, then you may hit red lights. So if the first person at the intersection is a speeder, when they get to the next signal, they're likely to see a red light when they arrive there. If they're going at the assumed speed, then they would get a green light.
According to the city, traffic light synchronization on Herndon Avenue has decreased the average commute time by 5 minutes. And because cars idle less at traffic signals, the potential for improved air quality in the region is high, Weimiller says.
Our experience in the past has been a 23% reduction in commute times. So depending on how far they're traveling, we expect them to be able to improve that by about 20% or so.
Weimiller is looking forward to the synchronization of Shaw Avenue. He says he's excited to see the reports from the city's central traffic operation system after the Shaw project is completed so tweaks can be made to the route.
We have real-time information about traffic flow, traffic counts. All of that is being captured in a real-time basis. We work very purposefully to keep traffic flowing as smoothly as possible.
After the Shaw Avenue project is complete, the city hopes to connect areas of town that aren't on the fiber optic network via wireless connectors to improve traffic flow throughout the rest of Fresno. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
Give me the green light. I'm ready to go right now. I'm ready to go right now.
Well, I'm sure a lot of you are happy to hear about those changes coming to Shaw Avenue. Well, get ready for some changes in the way your child is going to be educated. the Common Core State Standards, a new group of standards. Well, they provide a consistent, clear understanding of what students are expected to learn so teachers and parents know what they need to do to help them. Now, the standards are designed to be relevant to the real world, reflecting the knowledge and skills that young people need for success in not only college, but careers. Here to discuss this issue with us is Camilla Sutherland, School Improvement Coordinator for the Fresno County Office of Education, and Jonathan Dueck. He is the STEM Coordinator, which stands for Science, Technology, and Math Coordinator for Fresno County Office of Education. Thank you both.
Good morning.
Okay,
thank you.
Now, when
thank
did
you.
This happen? We've got a new group of standards. I'm sure people are still trying to figure out No Child Left Behind. So where did this come from? Where did the Common Core State Standards originate, and why?
The standards began originating approximately 5 years ago, 4 years ago, and it was a group of state chief superintendents and the National Governors Association. They got together saying, we need to have standards that are, first of all, aligned to what other nations are doing, but also aligned within our nation. Every state has the option to have their own set of standards, but most nations actually have a national set of standards. So the United States had individual standards for each state, which was unusual in comparison to other countries in this world. So they said, let's have a set of standards that we can all choose from, yet to maintain their autonomy, you could actually choose if you wanted to adopt these standards for your state or not. So most states have chosen to adopt them, but there are three or four who have said, we want to maintain what we've had for the past few years and not be a part of this Common Core movement.
What's important about having common standards, you think?
Well, I think, too, with what they're doing, it's our community is very mobile. They're going from states to states, and if we're having education that's a national education, it's best to have what we're doing in California being aligned to what they're doing in New York. And we're measuring the same thing. Before, we were measuring apples and oranges when it came down to which state was performing better or not.
It's also not just about comparing who's doing better, but it's also about seeing who's doing well that we can emulate what they're doing and share resources. That way, if we hear of a state or an area that is succeeding in educating their students, we have a common language that we're speaking now, and we won't be looking at, well, what do you teach in first grade? What do you teach in third grade, 10th grade? We can all speak to the point of, here's what we're doing every year with our students. This is a scope and sequence that's common among all of our states.
What brought this about? You know, there had been a number of studies, no secret, that our children were behind when it came to certain standards. When you looked at math and science, our reading levels, there was a lot of problems. So what kind of went into this? Were you hearing from colleges saying, okay, you're sending us students who aren't really prepared? And I know you've heard from businesses saying, you're sending us young people who just aren't ready.
We have a number of countries is the wrong word. We have a number of businesses saying we have students that, again, aren't prepared for what's happening. So we want to go with the phrase that you read earlier, and that is that we want our students to be college and career ready. So we want them to graduate from high school, being able to go into appropriate community college or university, but also be prepared to move into a career, some kind of trade school, but have options available for them. We don't want students to finish high school and then be tracked into, I only have this available. So we can look at, for example, the math standards. The Common Core is only for language arts and mathematics. There aren't other standards and other content areas, just those two for Common Core. In our current math standard, well, I should say our previous math standards, which California had since 1997, when you read them, the phrases and verbs in there are about students will be able to do this. So we want our kids to be able to do these things. When you look at the Common Core, those are written from the point of view of students will understand. So there's a big difference between a student being able to say that 2 + 2 = 4 and for a kindergartner to understand the concept of how much 2 is, how much 2 more is, and that it equals 4.
Was that a piece that had been missing? You know, because a lot of times I can remember reading the standards and it was, students will be ready to do this. They will learn this. They will, you know, it's like you were beating them over the head without anything in there for the way students really learn.
Right. And I think that's where it comes down to that critical thinking part, like John was saying, that we don't want just the right answer, but how did you get to that right answer, that deeper understanding? And I think that's why when we look at what our business folks want, they want people that can think on their feet, can take and do something with the materials that they have. College remediation classes, you know, those were high. So now if our kids are thinking and not just coming up with the right answer, that's going to help them alleviate all those problems too.
All of our standards from the past have been good and well-intentioned. I think that the wording in the Common Core is what makes everything more rigorous, more coherent, and focused so that we can look at these standards for more solid teaching and what's going on. And we also have to separate the idea of the standards, what's being taught, and the assessment that kids are taking. We can talk about what does this assessment look like. And the assessment we've been taking, the California Standards Test, has been a multiple choice test, whereas the assessment that will be going along with the Common Core is going to be more open-ended and be more rigorous in terms of what's expected.
How will this be different? What will parents see that's different?
I think they're going to see more of students justifying what their answers are. There's going to be more citing evidence from their learning, from their reading, from their writing. There's more writing that's going to be involved, not only in language arts but in math, coming up with explaining how you came up with your answer. There's going to be more research, more use of technology. So looking at the global student that's involved with our kids today, they've got a lot of that technology right there in front of them that we're always asking them, how do we do this? And as students, we're putting that, what they're doing, into practice.
We don't want to see students who are able to just do it. We want students to be able to do it and figure out how to do more. So we want all of the people that graduate from our high schools to be able to persevere and problem solve, to be able to critically think, to understand, to see the real world application of what's happening. And we can fall into a trap as educators of really trying to get our kids to just pass a test, but we really want our kids to pass a test but be able to go on and apply that knowledge somewhere.
To understand what I think I hear you saying is you want students to really understand what it is they're learning.
Exactly.
Because that's one of the things that I even saw with my own child. They know how to do it, but when you ask them, how did you get there? Why did you do it? They really didn't know.
And that kind of education will only give you short-term results. If I teach someone how to do it, they can do it for the short term. But then when there's that application piece, they're going to give you a blank stare. And that's what we want to avoid, obviously.
And Juanita, too, some of the things you were talking about, what will parents see in the community, it's more collaboration, too. They're more working together. And so I think some of that is different than the way that we were taught in school. We did it on ourselves, and then we answered our test. But this is more that group learning, but everyone's going to be held accountable. So that whole idea that, well, then that won't – everybody won't be learning. But everyone's going to have a part in that. Teachers will be working together to develop lessons. Students working together to – feed off of each other, getting their thoughts going.
You know, one of the things that I did read about this is that it describes, you know, what they should teach. But what it did say is that it seems to me, from what I've read, they're going to give teachers a lot of leeway in how they go about doing it, because that's been one of the long complaints of teachers is, you know, the way that they had to teach before, when it was what people felt like teaching to a test. Mm-hmm. And being able to be creative. Now, that is part of this. Now, aren't teachers aren't being told how they should really
Something that happened back in 1997 when we adopted our previous standards was that there were teachers who you just had more flexibility in the content, what you were going to teach, and that led to more flexibility on how you were going to teach it. Once we had standards in place, that kind of outlined what needed to be taught at every level, and layer over that there was an assessment that was becoming more and more important for them to reach up towards. So now we're going to have an assessment that is broader and more rigorous, and so the way we teach has to align to that. So we need to have teaching that stretches our kids, pushes our kids, and is more rigorous for them. And that's what businesses want. They want people coming to them who are prepared to work hard, to problem solve, and to figure things out. So it's not just about what is the answer, but what's the answer and how did you figure that out?
How will math change? Because I know they put in new standards for math a while back, And, you know, with children having to take algebra, blah, 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 blah. But then, I just say that, but then when they got in the workplace, I mean, I talk to employers all the time with young people not even understanding basic math.
Absolutely. One of the problems that came out of our previous standards, and I shouldn't even say it was a problem, but an issue that came up was having algebra for all eighth graders. And even though the idea of really pushing our kids to move for that, some of our kids weren't ready for that. Just academically weren't prepared for algebra. So with the Common Core, there is still going to be algebraic concepts taught. Actually, starting in kindergarten, there'll be some algebraic concepts taught. For example, when you have 2 plus star equals 4, figuring out what that star is an algebraic concept. So when you look at what students are going to be taught in eighth grade now, there is still some of that algebra being taught there, but it's stretched out, kind of integrated with geometry and algebra too, so that once a student hits eighth grade, they'll be part of a multi-year plan to have strong conceptual mathematical thinking. Not just here's how you do it, but to understand why that works. An example that I like to use is when a student is in working on dividing fractions. Many of us know how to divide fractions. We say, oh, you invert and multiply. You flip the second fraction and then you multiply them across. But no one knows why that works. If we can talk about here's why you do that, which is a really simple thing and actually pretty cool why you invert and multiply, that gives kids a deeper understanding of the mathematics right there. So the idea is deeper, not just a whole bunch of information, but solid information that kids really understand.
You know, what I'd like to do is share with both of you and our listeners, these are some of the comments we got back from Facebook regarding these new standards, some of them coming from teachers. So Peggy Dwayne Pope, eighth grade teacher in Bakersfield, wrote, "I think it will benefit all of us!" Exclamation point. Another teacher, Karen Sylvester MacArthur, she teaches seventh grade, and she says she agrees. She believes the new standards are much more rigorous and will benefit students and teachers. However, there will be a very big learning curve in the first 2 to 3 years, especially for older students who have been educated to take only bubble tests. In these standards, I see a return to how we were trained and how we used to teach prior to No Child Left Behind and state standards. So there is also an emphasis, again, on writing across the curriculum, something which has been missing in the current standards. So it seems like one other comment from Karen McGruth. Oh, I'm in this. Okay, I like the interconnectedness across content areas. I love the emphasis on writing to articulate your thinking, and I hope it lives up to its purpose to have fewer standards, which will allow teachers to go deeper into topics. So it seems like, just according to this, from what the teachers have read, they really like this. We all know that not only teachers, but a number of people had a problem with No Child Left Behind.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I agree with your comments that you're saying there too, Juanita, from your listeners, is that it's helping teachers do what they like to do and helping students learn. I mean, writing is a way of clarifying their thinking. And like John talks about with math, I've had a couple of teachers that I've worked with. When students have to write down how they solve the problem, their thinking was clearer. And that's what we're wanting to do, is have those students be able to think after they've left that classroom and left that teacher. And it's exciting, too, when teachers are saying that, because it's a change. They look at it as a change, but it's really going deeper into what they've been good at doing in the past.
Now, how long is it going to take to implement all this? You know, they're not going to show up in the fall and everything's going to be ready. How is this going to be implemented? How is it going to be – is it going to be phased in, or how will that work?
Students – I mean, the standards were adopted in 2010. So there has been – and districts do different – methods of getting it implemented, but they've been looking at the standards, and most schools are working on implementation now. The actual timeline that will be starting is 2014-15, when all the standards will be ready to do their first round of testing. And like that one listener said, there will be a curve there at the beginning because it is new. But I think they've been working on what are those standards, how are we going to teach them, doing collaboration, getting professional development.
Right. And so a district could – they could be teaching the Common Core standards right now if they wanted to. It's that the new assessments will begin, like Camilla said, in 2014-15. So districts have local control of when they want to actually begin implementing these standards. So some of them are implementing them at some grade levels, for example, perhaps kindergarten first, maybe second grade. Some of them are doing those grade levels and middle school to prepare the kids for high school. Regardless of when you teach, you're really – the math is the math. of what we're doing. You know, the content is the content. So there are a few differences between our previous standards and our current standards. There's more depth to our current standards. So some teachers are a little trepidatious because they have a current CST based on different standards test that they're taking at the end of the year. So that's what's holding a few teachers, sites, districts back from doing it. So it's their choice of when they want to implement. But some are going fully at this point. Some are going to go fully implemented next year. But kind of like you said, it's not going to be easy to do all of this. There's going to be a little bit of a curve. And the example I like to give is that if you were to graph this, you would see what's called a J curve. And that means if you can picture the letter J tilted to the right, that scores tend to dip the first time you try something new.
Yeah.
And then they go up. And so we have to be prepared that some people are going to do really well the first year and some people are going to do not so well the first year. But we work at this for a few years because it's a quality program, and if we want it to succeed, we have to work at that. And so we'll see a slight dip with some places, and we'll go straight up with other places.
Okay. Well, thank you both, and thanks for coming in and sharing this information on the new Common Core State Standards. Camilla Sutherland, School Improvement Coordinator for the Fresno County Office of Education, and Jonathan Dueck, STEM Coordinator, Fresno County Office of Education. Thank you both. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Well, the 9th annual Fresno Film Festival is going to feature a number of good programs, 7 programs with 21 movies from 13 different countries. The festival runs through April 19th through the 21st. Of course, the movie's being shown at the historic Tower Theater. Here to talk about this year's lineup is John Moses, Fresno Filmworks president. Thanks so much for coming in. You are now in your 9th year. It's getting to be a great little film festival, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. We're growing each year. It's presented by Fresno Filmworks, and we've been at the Tower Theater for 11, but this is our 9th festival, and so we pack a lot of entertainment into one weekend for those who are especially interested in independent film, foreign language film, films that won't be coming to the commercial theaters. This is the place to see it, at the Historic Tower Theater.
Right, and you've got a really good lineup, but you say you always do, but this year. Some of the feature films you're going to be showing throughout the festival are really good.
Yeah, we try to have as much diversity in the program as possible. So we got a romantic comedy from France for our opening night show, Paris, Manhattan, a little homage to Woody Allen's romantic comedies from the past. And we'll hear Woody Allen within the film as well. But we have a very long-awaited adaptation of On the Road for Saturday Night. This is a film that in some ways has been in the process of being made for almost 30 years.
A long time.
Yes. That's got some pretty exciting young stars in the film for that iconic adaptation of
it's got Kristen Stewart from Twilight movie fame, but she does a lot of independent movies that people don't know
about. In some
ways,
she was cast for that role before the Twilight hit. So,
and also one of your short films, The Flight of the Tortoise.
Yeah, a sweet little Israeli romantic comedy that goes with the Woody Allen feature film Friday Night.
And then on Sunday, your feature film is going to be More Than Honey?
Yes, in the afternoon, we've got the documentary. This is a film still in the festival circuit, so it's not playing theatrically anywhere yet. We're excited about that. It's about the crisis with honeybee pollination, and very important for agricultural issues. And some of the film, while it's a European film, it's set in Switzerland, it's set in China, but it's also set in the Central Valley.
But also what's great about this is that on each of these nights, you get to participate in this discussion. Which I think is really great for people who really love film.
Right. Yeah, we have discussion circles after most of the films. We've got experts on the subject matter that is connected to the film and just invite people to stay for a period of time afterward to talk about the film and have some questions about it.
What does it take for you? When do you start looking for the movies you want to feature for the festival?
For the festival, we start looking in December, usually. We've already, by December, we already have gotten a great many of the shorts that are going to be submitted to us. So those start coming in November, and we're watching those for about 3-month period before deciding. But for the features, we start really considering what's out there and available to us, still not on the home market, maybe still playing festival circuits around the country. What can we bring here? And in some ways, the digital revolution is serving us, I guess, because in the past, where we tried to show as many 35-millimeter films as possible, now that fewer and fewer are going to be presented that way. On the Road is a 35-millimeter print for Saturday night, so that's terrific. But because we're able to show in digital formats, we don't have to always compete with the larger festivals and be told that we don't have a print for you now. You'd have to wait. So, we are being able to show a wider range than maybe we were able to show 5 years ago.
That's great. And I know we're talking about the festival, but, Fresno Filmworks, you show movies all year round, or you try to go after some of those independent
movies,
just like you talked about,
yes,
that you don't get to see anywhere else.
Exactly. And we've got we already have our programming set for our second Friday May film. That's when we usually show two screenings on the second Friday of each month. We've got a Chilean film, another Chilean film, because we have one in the festival. In the festival, it's Violeta Went to Heaven. It's a wonderful independent film from Chile. And in May, it's going to be a pretty prominent film, a political drama, No, which is about a campaign against the military junta and replacement of that.
You know, this festival, it's been in its 9th year. What kind of impact do you think it has on this region?
Well, I think it fosters an excitement about cinematic art. It draws together a community of patrons who really appreciate that kind of art form. And so it serves that community that's interested in something a little bit different than they get in commercial theaters. And I also think it ultimately helps to foster filmmakers who are inspired with what they see on screen, and they want to pursue their own cinematic visions themselves with careers.
How has the community kind of responded to?
We have people coming to our films that have been coming for 11 years. So we see familiar faces. I think the community has really stepped up this year to help sponsor our films and our festival. So we've seen a huge swell of support this year. We are getting the word out there in ways that perhaps we haven't before.
Now, to attend the festival or to see a certain movie you might want to see, you can purchase a ticket for a whole day or just one film?
There are festival passes that are, I think, very reasonably priced, $40 for the entire weekend. As advance at the door would be $50. That's, again, for 7 programs. Individual programs are $10 general admission, $8 for students or seniors. So if you're planning on coming to a number of the films, which I hope people do, I would get online and through PayPal purchase one of those passes for, $40.
I think the more and more people find out about it, I think the tickets are going to go. So if there's a certain movie or the whole festival looks great, you should probably get your tickets now.
And the whole lineup is at our website, FresnoFilmworks.org, so they can see synopsis.
That's where you can get all the information. Yes. Thanks again so much for coming back to see us again this year.
Okay, thank you, Juanita.
Look forward to next year. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weber, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.